22. Turning it back. It won't work, Mara remarked, standing with Luke and staring at the little ice borer, the stylish ship, which seemed terribly frail for the mission Luke had assigned to it. Lando's used this technology before, he replied. Going into a planet full of enemies, came his wife's curt response. She turned up her hand, extending her fingers one at a time, as she counted off the drawbacks. You'll have no weapons. None from the ship, at least. No shields, other than the forward heat and impact protection. And not enough speed to outrun a headhunter, never mind one of those coral skippers. Luke stared at her long and hard, a smile widening on his face. Ever since the return from Belkaden, Mara had been in her room, recuperating, a poignant reminder that she was very ill, and yet here she was concerned about him. I should be the one to take the ice borer in, she said. Luke's smile evaporated. He knew the source of that remark, knew that she was, in fact, saying that her life was more expendable because she was ill. By all other examples, terminally ill. No way, he replied. Mara looked at him hard. If you suffer a relapse down there, you'll jeopardize the whole mission, Luke stated flatly, elevating the discussion to the good of the mission, and not to a condescending level that showed his concern for his wife. And if I have a relapse flying your carry ship? She asked with thick sarcasm. You won't, Luke replied with all confidence, and he chuckled and started past her. Mara just shook her head and watched him walk away for a few moments, then turned back to regard the seemingly fragile, stylish ship and just sighed. They're almost done with it, Jaina told her brothers as the three watched the repairs on the strange little ship. Uncle Luke's really going to take that thing in? Anakin asked. And he's really going to wear that living suit and mask they found with the pilot? Jason and Jaina exchanged concerned looks. He's trying out the suit right now, Jaina explained. Why don't you go and check it out? Not catching on to the pointed dismissal and anxious to get a glimpse of the alien artifacts, the ever-curious Anakin took his leave in a hurry. Uncle Luke's the wrong one to go, Jason said to Jaina as soon as they were alone. I'm more concerned about Aunt Mara, Jaina replied. She slept most of the day and was still exhausted when she got up to eat dinner. Did you see the dark circles under her eyes? Her disease is getting the best of her right now, mostly because she's too preoccupied with all of this. They stared at each other long and hard, knowing that they were of like mind, though neither was brave enough to put the thoughts to words at that moment. We can't let Mara go, Jaina remarked. We can't stop her if Uncle Luke goes, Jason replied. You think they'll wait for the Rejuvenator and her escorts to come in before they leave? Jaina asked. I think they'll go first, Jason replied. I heard Uncle Luke say as much to Dad. He doesn't want to wait for anything, but his plan is to get the ice borer off-planet just in time to meet up with the incoming fleet. Jaina merely nodded. She had gleaned similar information from C-3PO. What's that? Jason asked, motioning toward a crane bringing another craft into a scaffolding beside and above the ice borer. Carry ship, Jaina explained, who had interviewed Lando's technicians extensively on this subject. You can't dock the ice borer or put it in a hold because it's not maneuverable enough to break away safely. They'll load it onto the missile pod of the carry ship, and that ship will just point it in the right direction and shoot it off. And the ice borer pilot has to stay in the stylish ship the whole time? Jason asked. For the duration of the entire flight? The whole time, Jaina replied. They use an air tube and a power transfer line from the carry ship to conserve all the power possible on the little ice borer, but whoever flies in that thing is going to be lying flat out and cramped the whole way to the Helska system. Jason looked at her, smiled, and nodded. Jaina spent a long while dissecting that look, making certain that Jason was entertaining similar ideas to her own. I can fly the ice borer, she offered. Seems to me that your skills would be better suited for the carry ship. Jaina thought about it and didn't disagree. If they had to pull a quick retreat from the Helska system, she'd be a better choice at piloting the main craft. Where's our two? Jason asked. We should leave a message. Luke paced the room while Han, Leia, and Lando sat at the small round table, arguing about whether they should go ahead and attack with the assembled fleet or wait for more firepower to come in. On the table sat a viewscreen, the imposing image of Commander Warshak Rojo of the Star Destroyer Rejuvenator, with his shaved head, furrowed brow, and a single glittering diamond earring. We should go straight to Helska, Commander Rojo insisted. The Ranger gunships will handle any of the smaller... what did you call them? Coral skippers? While Rejuvenator takes out whatever base those barbarians have set up. It will be a clean sweep, I assure you. And then we can get on with the more important issues facing the New Republic. You may join us in system if you desire. Han and Leia exchanged concerned smiles, not sure at all that Commander Rojo was getting the message that this likely was the most important issue facing the New Republic. Leia was hardly surprised by the apparent underestimation. 6 days, she argued. We'll have 3 battle cruisers, an interdictor ship, another Star Destroyer, and their accompanying task forces in by then. We need not wait, the commander, a hard-headed Corellian, said. I've enough firepower to level the enemy base, and the planet it's on, if need be. Leia gave a helpless sigh. She knew well enough how stubborn a Corellian could be, and turned to her brother as he paced by the window. Luke had told her that she would never convince the commander to wait until the other ships arrived, and since she had resigned her post on the council, she had no authority to order him to wait. They had put out a call to Coruscant, but it would be a while before they received any response. Leia's estimation of 6 days was a hopeful one at best, and by that time Rojo hoped to have this whole mess cleared up. Rojo's confidence did not bode well for Leia's hopes of assembling a larger fleet, she knew, for the commander had likely been, or soon would be, in contact with the more skeptical members of the council, assuring them that he could handle this and they need not divert any more of their military assets. We're going, Rojo said firmly. And if we have to go alone, then so be it. Leia sighed. Luke started to turn to say something to the stubborn man, but a flash beyond the window caught his eye. He moved closer, staring into the dark night, and saw a ship soar out of dock into the sky. He knew at once which ship it was, the Kerry ship, Mary Minor, and its ice-bore companion. Mara? He asked quietly, wondering for a second if his wife had decided to take on this dangerous mission by herself. But his words made little logical sense. Mara couldn't have gone alone, for it would take 2 pilots to accomplish the task. And he didn't believe that she would have taken Jaina on such a dangerous trek without consulting Leia. A sickly feeling came over Luke then, inspired by the thought of Mara's potential co-pilot, as he guessed who might be flying the Mary Minor and who might be accompanying her. He turned to the others, his expression speaking volumes. "What is it?" Leia asked. He ran past her to the door and out into the hall. "Good evening, sir," C-3PO said as Luke barreled into him, knocking him back against the opposite wall. "Not now," Luke said, rolling away from the droid, sidestepping R2-D2 and sprinting down the corridor. "But R2, sir!" "Not now," Luke cried. "A message from Master Jason!" the now-frantic C-3PO yelled. Luke skidded to a stop and came running back, just as Leia bent to R2-D2 and activated his hologram recorder. "Uncle Luke," came the greeting, as a tiny image of Jason appeared in the hallway. "Forgive us our presumption, but it seemed obvious to me and to Jaina that you're needed with the fleet in the main attack force. We know what you intended within the 4th planet, to explore and determine the strength and purpose of our enemies. We can do that, Uncle Luke." Han gave something akin to a growl, and Leia joined in. "Keep Aunt Mara at rest. She needs it." Jason's hologram went on. "Jaina and I will be fine, and will carry out the mission perfectly. We promise." The image went away. "I'm gonna kick his," Han started to say. "Jason's right," Luke interrupted, and both Han and Leia, and Lando as well, stared at him in disbelief. "I wish they had come to me first," Luke went on. "I wish they had better coordinated their intentions." But you think that sending Jason down into the planet is the right choice? Leia finished for him. As good a choice as any, Luke replied without hesitation. He grabbed Han by the arm as the man started away, and from the look on Han's face, it was obvious that he was heading straight off for the Millennium Falcon. You're raising Jedi Knights, Luke said to him in all seriousness. Warriors, explorers. They can't turn away from the duty that is before them just for our peace of mind. They're just kids, Han argued. And so were we when the Empire unveiled the Death Star, Luke reminded. Speak for yourself, Han growled. He narrowed his eyes as he stared hard at his friend. I just went halfway across the galaxy, pulling one of them back, and now I've got the other two running off in another direction, he muttered through gritted teeth. Luke looked to Leia and managed, with his expression, to coax a smile onto her face. Get used to it, he said to Han, and enjoy it while you can. You won't be able to keep up with them much longer. Han pulled roughly away and muttered a stream of curses, and only then did Luke begin to understand the depth of his anger and frustration. He had just lost Chewbacca, and he wasn't about to lose anyone else. It is settled then, came the voice of Commander Rojo behind them. It has begun. Just because they went out doesn't mean that we have to send the whole fleet in pursuit, Leia replied. Han, Luke, and I can go after them in the Falcon. Their leaving actually hurts your intentions, Commander, Luke added. If our enemies detect the Kerry ship, they'll be waiting for the larger fleet behind them. A band of smugglers, Commander Rojo said derisively. Or some puny liberation group. They've found a new technology, and they believe that with it they can challenge the New Republic. But they have nothing that will stand before Rejuvenator. I go. And he did just that, dipping a curt bow and abruptly breaking the comlink. Han and Luke looked at each other for a long moment. Why'd you have to make them Jedi? Han asked, and it was obvious from his tone, from the fact that he finished with that typical Han Solo snicker, that Luke's argument had gotten through to him. You coming with us? Han asked Lando. I thought I'd stay here and make sure the planetary defenses are in place, a flustered Lando replied, as soon as the surprise of the question wore off a bit. Glad to have you, Han said, ignoring the answer and turning to Leia. Go get Anakin. He's handling the gun pod. You, Leia, Anakin, and Kip, Lando reasoned. Force plenty for the Falcon. Me, Anakin, Leia, and you, Han corrected. Kip's going to lead a starfighter squadron off Rejuvenator. Already arranged it with Rojo. My fighting days, Lando started to insist, have only just begun, Han interrupted. Lando threw up his hands in defeat, and the group moved away, Luke to go and rouse Mara, for he thought this too important a moment to keep her out of it, despite her exhaustion, and the others to find Anakin and to ready the Millennium Falcon. A short time later, the Falcon and the Jade Saber blasted away from Dubrillion, along with every worthy warship Lando could muster. Off-planet, they rendezvoused with Rojo's contingent, and after one last attempt by Leia to talk the proud commander out of going at that time, they all blasted away, full speed for the Helska system. Jaina brought them in perfectly, the sun between them and the fourth planet, just as Luke and Mara had done on their trip in. Uncle Luke fed all the coordinates into the Merry Miner's navigation computer, Jaina called down to Jason, who was lying flat out on his stomach in the narrow ice borer attached to the Kerry ship. Might get warm down there. We're in for a close pass. I'm going to sunburn every inch of my body, Jason remarked, a not-so-subtle reminder that he had climbed into the ice borer practically naked, wearing just a loose-fitting skirt, purloined from the dead pilot of the captured coral skipper. Even worse for him, because the entry hatch was so tiny, Jaina had to kneel behind him and very indelicately push him in, and all the while with him conscious of the fact that he was wearing only a skirt. A skirt! It'd be a long time before Jaina let him live that indignity down. I can come around and let you fly free before we ever get out of the Helskin Sun's sensor shield, Jaina offered. That's a long way for this thing to run, Jason observed. You'll be running on my power, not yours. Sure, but without any guns, Jason came back, and his tone was sarcastic, even light-hearted, as if he was just blowing off a bit of his nervousness. Just let them get close to you and blast that heat charge into them, Jaina returned with a laugh. Her tone grew serious immediately as she continued, You ready? Don't miss, came the reply. Jaina banked the carry ship around the sun, flying completely by instruments, which she never liked to do, for she was trusting the guidance of the coordinates Luke had put into the nav computer. She saw the screen before her focus in on a point of light, the fourth planet, and watched it grow and grow as the magnification increased. I got it, Jason, she informed her brother. Everything's lining up. If you fire any correcting jets, they might see them. So sit tight and trust my aim. Let her go, Jason replied. And don't stay down there more than a few minutes, Jaina added. I'm sitting pretty helpless up here. If they find you, turn it back to Debrillion, Jason said in all seriousness. Those words, ridiculous words by Jaina's estimation, for she would never, ever leave her brother behind, echoed ominously in her thoughts as she watched the coordinates align perfectly and gently squeeze the trigger. The stylus ship, Jason belly down and head forward, rocketed away. It was a smooth and quiet ride for Jason, absent the hum of any drives. A good portion of the ice bore was translucent, giving him the feeling that he was almost free-flying in empty space, a sense of serenity he had not expected in the face of the looming danger. He had to shake it away quickly. Jaina's orders that he not stay down there more than a few minutes were more than just words, he knew. Were necessity if he and his sister were to have any chance of slipping away. Now came the task that Jason had feared since they had left Dubrillion. He brought his bare toe down and prodded the alien suit, the Ooglith Cloaker, according to C-3PO's best translation, then held his breath as the obedient creature began its joining on his feet, then rolled up his legs, just as Anakin, after watching Luke's trial with the thing, had described. Jason squirmed and tried in vain to fall into some meditation, to leave the tingling stings of the inserting appendages far away. But it was too personal, and he felt them, every one, and so very keenly. At last it was complete, and as horrible as that experience had been, Jason knew the next would be even worse. Slowly, his hand faltering several times, he brought the star-shaped mask, the Nulith, up to his face and fought aside his gagging as the tube snaked down his throat. By the time he had finished, he looked ahead to see the fourth planet looming large before him. He knew that his Uncle Luke had set the coordinates to bring the ice borer down right near the mound he had perceived as the home base, and knew that was where he should go. But then Jason heard a call in his mind, a cry of distress, a cry for help that he could not ignore. He focused his thoughts on that cry, closed his eyes, and let the Force be his guide. Hardly thinking of the action, he gently touched the guidance jets, igniting a short burn that turned his nose to the side. And, he feared, likely alerted his enemies to his presence. Down, down he went, and he noted sparks of light, coral skippers, rising over the horizon on the far side of the planet. Come on, come on, Jason muttered, urging the ship on but not daring to fire another jet. Down, down, until all his screen filled with the grayish-white pall of the frozen planet. He glanced to the side to see the horde of coral skippers closing, looked back as he descended across the last few hundred meters. He almost forgot to fire the charge, but he did squeeze the trigger, and the shaped bomb leapt ahead of him, burrowing into the ice, and then exploding with a tremendous flash, the shock of it jolting Jason and the ice borer violently. He couldn't see a thing beyond the ice and vapor, couldn't tell if the charge had cut through to the water below. But he couldn't stop and wait either, and down he plunged, bouncing through the remains of the crust, careening left and right and nearly getting knocked unconscious. And then? It was quiet. So serene as the ice borer dived into the calm and cold waters below the crust. Behind him, the hole fast froze, and he could only hope that the pilots of the approaching coral skippers believed him dead in a fiery crash, or that his vessel approaching their planet was not a ship at all, but a missile launched at the planetary base. Either way, it didn't matter to Jason. All that he knew as his senses returned was the solitude and the welcome gloom. And that call. And it wasn't far away. "Uh-oh," Jaina whispered. Her instruments had picked up Jason's unexpected rocket firing and the subsequent approach by enemy coral skippers. She had seen the explosion on the surface of the fourth planet and could only hope it was the proper and planned explosion that Jason had blasted through the ice crust. She had to put those hopes aside, though, for now she had her own problems. Those coral skippers had turned her way, speeding off-planet. They couldn't see her, she knew, visually or with instruments, not with the Helsken sun right behind her. They were backtracking Jason's path, a trail that would lead to her, and the protection of that shielding sun wouldn't hold for long. The Mary Minor carried no weapons, and even with the improvements Lando's crew had made to her, wasn't particularly fast. Jaina turned back, closing her forward view screen as the glare of the Helsken sun exploded into view. She had to be perfect now, had to run so close to the sun that the coral skippers wouldn't see her and couldn't follow her if they did. This was her one advantage. The Mary Minor was solid, built to explode whatever worlds might provide valuable ore. She could get in close, very close, to a sun, certainly much closer than a typical starfighter. Jaina kept her attention glued to her navigational readings, bringing the ship in. She tried to ignore the other instruments screaming at her about the rising hull temperature, tried to ignore her own sensibilities that it was indeed becoming rather warm, even inside the ship. Her ion drives groaned in their fight against the sudden increase of gravity. Even with the bulkhead closed over her view screen, Jaina could see the brilliant glow shining through the supposedly tight seams. She turned aside, leveling off into a tight orbit, and using the gravity as a whip, as Luke and Mara had done, fast moving around the back side of the sun. She fought through every second, manipulating instruments to compensate against the pull, tugging hard to keep the Mary Minor from plunging into the Helsken sun. Ion drives groaned, instruments screamed in protest, and Jaina, feeling the G's and the violent vibrations, groaned too, and gave a yell, executing a vicious turn as she whipped around the backside. Then she had to hold on for all her life as the ship struggled through the tremendous gravity pull and tore free with a jolt that sent the young woman sprawling. She scrambled back to the console and retracted the bulkhead, beginning a quick assessment of the damage. "Uh-oh," she said again, for though the Mary Minor had performed admirably and had come through the ordeal fairly unscathed, the swift coral skippers had not broken pursuit, had flown at a faster and higher orbit about the sun. They saw her now, she knew, and she was out of tricks. Jason truly appreciated the simple yet brilliant design of the ice borer. He brought the little ship up against the planetary crust and extended small grabber arms to secure her in place. Then he took a deep breath, hoping it wouldn't be his last, hoping his Uncle Luke's information concerning this Nulith and the insulation of the Ooglith cloaker he was wearing was accurate. He punched the three-key sequence for underwater ejection, then brought his hand back as a locking panel slid over the instrument board. Other panels fell into place, encasing the man in a watertight compartment, its forward wall the outer hatch, and then, through a series of locks protecting him from any pounding pressures, water was brought into him, filling the compartment. At first, Jason held his breath as the water came over his face, but then, his hand securely on the abort button, he dared to take a breath. It felt watery and bubbly and somewhat uncomfortable, but he was okay, drawing air through the symbiotic appendage of the star-shaped creature. And he was not cold. And he paused a moment to consider how magnificent this living bodysuit truly was. The outer compartment slid open, and Jason crawled out into the open water. He spent just a moment checking his equipment, his lightsaber and the small sensor key that would guide him back into his ship, and then he turned his attention to the watery world about him. He saw the lights in the distance, far away and far below. At first he thought them to be some natural phenomenon, volcanic activity perhaps, and wondered if he was giving the Ooglith cloaker too much credit. Maybe the water here wasn't really all that cold. As he crawled forward, walking his hands along the crust to get a better angle of the glow, he recognized the lights for what they were, some sort of organized base. A host of worries crossed through Jason's mind at that moment. He felt that he looked enough like one of the Coral Skipper pilots, with his mask and second-skin clothing, even the skirt that the alien pilot had worn. He prayed that the male pilots wore the same uniform as the females, but how would he communicate with them? How would he slip by any sentries? He took another deep and steadying breath, reminding himself that he was a Jedi, and that Jedi, above all else, could improvise through tight situations. And there was one other thing aiding him, for that mysterious call had not abated, and seemed even stronger now, and very close. To Jason's surprise and relief, it didn't appear to be coming from the distant lighted base, but from up here, near the crust. He moved swiftly, reminding himself that time was of the essence, crawling along the underside of the great ice crust, letting the call guide him. Then he came to an abrupt halt, for not far away before and below him came a procession of lights, a half-dozen rising through the water toward him. Jaina bit her lip and throttled the Merry Miner out to full, though the speed of the closing coral skippers mocked her attempted run. She thought to turn about, to plunge again into the shielding vicinity of the Helskin sun, but then realized that even that option had closed to her, for some of the coral skippers had fanned out to block her way back. "They've got me," she muttered, and for the first time since she had begun training with Mara, Jaina felt truly helpless, as if all her work becoming a Jedi could do nothing now to save her. She started to put out a telepathic call, a farewell, but then, sensing something, she opened her eyes and nearly toppled with relief. The Rejuvenator came out of hyperspace right before her. Other ships, cruisers, and gunships appeared, and before Jaina could even open a channel and warn the approaching fleet, the great Star Destroyer dropped into attack mode. X-wings and other starfighters zoomed out of her bays. Her great forward laser cannons opened up, streaks of light sizzling past Jaina. "Hey there, Merry Miner," came a familiar voice, and Jaina had never imagined that she would ever be this happy to hear Kip Duran. "You need a little help?" A squadron of X-wings roared past, the lead ship waggling its wings at her. "You're going to need more help when I get you back home," came another voice, her father's voice, and the Millennium Falcon and then the Jade Saber came into view. "Get behind us," Luke added. "We'll take care of these guys." Jaina gladly did as told, letting the Falcon and the Jade Saber and the whole fleet soar past her, between her and the Coral Skipper group. The quickly diminishing Coral Skipper group, she realized, as she brought the Merry Miner about and took a quick survey of the battle. The enemy had been taken by surprise, it seemed, and Coral Skipper after Coral Skipper went up in a blaze of sparkling pieces. Others did manage to turn for home, but then came yet another voice across all channels. "This is Rojo," it said. "Let's take it right to their home." Jaina throttled up to full. She had to keep up. She would be of no help in the fighting, of course, but she couldn't forget that her brother was on that planet. Jason didn't know whether to flee or fight, but found the point to be moot, for the nearest masked alien waved him into line. "They think I'm one of them," Jason told himself, bolstering his confidence, and he nodded and started forward. He was met by the scowling eyes of all six, and he understood then the dynamics at work here. He might be one of them, but something in either his uniform or demeanor indicated that he was of lesser rank. He paused a moment to study the group, their order, and any differences he might find to distinguish each. The eyes, he realized. The apparent leader, the one who had motioned to him, had only one eye. In place of the other was some kind of strange node looking grafted on. The skin around both of his sockets, the only part of his true skin that was visible because of the Ooglith cloaker and the star-shaped breather, was heavily tattooed. Jason noted that each succeeding warrior carried fewer scars or tattoos on that one exposed region. He remembered the dead alien pilot back at Dubrillion and the warrior his uncle had brought back from Belkaden. Both bodies maimed and tattooed, scars crisscrossing scars. If his guess was right, both of those humanoids at Lando's base must have been high-ranking members of this strange people. Following that intuition, Jason moved deferentially back down the line, taking the last position, and following the group up to the ice cap, then along the surface to a hole that led into an airy, roughly dome-shaped chamber. Jason knew at once that this small room held the unknown caller. He went in slowly, at the end of the line, poking his head out of the water tentatively. He had to fight hard to keep his eyes from widening in horror, for there in the corner curled a man, a Jedi Knight, and one that Jason knew. The lead warriors of his procession had already moved next to Miko Reglia, had already began punching him and grabbing at his arms, trying to hoist him up. Jason glanced to the other side to see a woman, a beautiful woman, her fighting spirit obviously still intact, standing agitated but helpless between a pair of enemies. To Jason's surprise, he recognized the woman and not Miko Reglia as the source of the telepathic call. He climbed up into the chamber and moved beside the last warrior that had come in, the lowest ranking besides himself, he believed. That warrior scowled at him and pointed back to the hole. "You thug," he growled, and Jason understood that the warrior wanted him to get back into the water. The last, the least, was meant to take a post as a sentry, he guessed, and now he was the last. Jason turned back to the cold water. "Come, Miko," he heard the leader of the group say, and he was surprised that these disfigured barbarians spoke his language. "It is time to die." Jason stopped, despite himself. "Leave him alone," the woman across the way pleaded. "You're just going to fake it again. They don't mean it, Miko." She ended her speech abruptly with a gasp as the warrior beside her doubled her over with a heavy punch to her gut. "You thug!" the other warrior screamed at Jason again. Jason looked up and noted that the warrior's eyes had widened in surprise. "Bososi," the warrior asked him, pointing to his belt where his lightsaber hung. Jason glanced right to see the two leaders hoisting Miko up brutally, then glanced back to the left to see two of the four over there coming toward him, demanding to know what it was that he carried on his belt. He pulled the lightsaber free and extended the glowing blade, cutting a sweep that slashed through the nearest warrior's knee, severing the leg and dropping him with an agonized howl. "Go, Miko," Jason prompted his fellow Jedi, but he knew before he even looked that way that Miko didn't have much, if any, fight left in him, that he was a broken shell of a man. This was Jason's fight.